Okay, I'm Bruce McEwen. I'm a neuroscientist at the Rockefeller University in New York. I study the brain, and what I'll be talking about is how the social environment affects the brain, and through the brain affects the rest of the body, health and disease through the life course, and introduce the concept of epigenetics, which really talks about how environmental factors regulate expression of genes and affect brain and body function. So hopefully you'll be able to see the slides, but I'll do my best to explain things for people in the back. It's great to be here, and thank you for coming on a beautiful sunny day, spending time indoors. And what I'm going to tell you, explaining these terms, epigenetics, and what I mean by biological embedding, is a story about putting the brain into the context of the social as well as physical environment that we live in, and also how the life course, how it understanding what happens throughout the life course is very important to understanding the final outcome, not only for brain function, but also for function of the rest of the body, because I'm a neuroendocrinologist and interested in how the brain and body communicate through hormones, through the autonomic nervous system, through the immune system and the metabolic system. And you'll hear a bit about all of that. So it's not just focused on the brain itself, but how the brain and the body interact with each other. I had the good fortune several decades ago to become part of a MacArthur Foundation network on socioeconomic status and health. Many of you probably know the pioneering work of Sir Michael Marmot in the Whitehall study, showing that as a function of income and education, there are gradients of health, of mortality, and also, we now know physical health and risk for disease from people at the highest income and education levels increasing to people at the lowest levels with almost a linear gradient. So we're talking not about the extremes of poverty or wealth, but factors, as we say, how education and income or socioeconomic status get under the skin. And of course, this may be due to perceptive factors, social position, actually the perceived or the actual position, discrimination, perceived or actual, education, resources, money, intellect, life skills, very important, access to health care, lifestyle, diet, alcohol, smoking, exercise, sleep should be on here. Stressors also from work, from family, from our neighborhood, from life events. And you'll hear more about all of these. The history of biomedicine, as characterized by Neil Halfon at UCLA in Los Angeles, started with the view of course, conquering infectious disease. Magic bullets, antibiotics, and this was the original biomedical model. Then, going back to 1977, but very much into the present, there was the recognition of risk factors related to stress, health behaviors, the social environment, the things that will be a major focus of today's talk. The so-called biopsychosocial model. And we're in the midst of appreciating the so-called non-communicable diseases for which there are not magic bullets, and a lifestyle change and a whole variety of factors that we're gripping with every day are involved. But that's not all, because we have to consider what happens early in life, what happens at conception, from conception on through the rest of the life, because what happens at each stage has an influence on what happens at the next stages. And we'll hear more about that as we go forward. In fact, epigenetics Waddington in 1942 used the term to refer to the emergence of characteristics. If you see a fertilized egg of a frog or a human being, you can't really tell from the fertilized egg what's going to happen next. But as you begin to see the emergence of the individual characteristics of each species and ultimately each individual, that was what was originally meant by epigenetics. Now it means above the genome. That is, things which do not change the DNA sequence, but alter how genes are expressed. And thus it refers to gene-environment interactions that bring about the individual characteristics of each of us, including differences between identical twins. This involves things which I'll briefly refer to. Those of you who have some science background will appreciate the modification of proteins called histones, which regulate the folding and unfolding of the DNA so it can expose its information, the binding of transcription regulators to regulate the DNA to RNA to protein sequence, methylation of certain bases of the four bases of DNA that don't change the genetic code but alter how all of this is happening, and something called non-coding or microRNAs, which are not the ones that code for proteins. They regulate the expression of other genes. And then there is something called transposons and retrotransposons, which actually do involve DNA rearrangements. And I'll come back to this as we go forward. Those of you who might be interested in finding out more about epigenetics, there is a U.S. public PBS.org program, the NOVA series, which you can easily find on the internet. And if you put in epigenetics, you'll get a 13-minute video, which is very, very informative. So this is what people mean by the methylation, putting a methyl group, a carbon with three hydrogens, onto a cytosine base, which doesn't change the sequence, as I said, of DNA, but alters how that particular stretch of DNA is going to be expressed or not expressed. Again, you won't be able to see the writing, but this is a paper in a journal showing that the methylation pattern, the staining of the chromosomes, the methylation pattern of a pair of three-year-old identical twins is virtually the same. But when you get to be 55 years old, there are considerable differences in the methylation pattern, which is a reflection of the individual experiences, including diet and exposure to pesticides and the life experiences that we all have, that results in the reason that twins are, yes, very similar in some respects, but not absolutely identical in their behavior or their risk for disease. This part of this figure, which you'll see again and again, relates to the output of the brain through the autonomic neuroendocrine, metabolic, and immune systems. The activation of these systems when we are stressed or exposed to some challenge, we refer to as allostasis, which is the active process of adaptation. But for all of the activation of this system, there is wear and tear on the body and brain, which we call allostatic load. And you'll hear more about this momentarily. In fact, one of the major stress hormones, which of course also is an important hormone in our daily day-night life, it's not just a stress hormone, is cortisol. And cortisol is produced by the adrenal cortex in response to ACTH from the pituitary gland, and that receives signals, chemical signals from the hypothalamus to stimulate this cascade that results in cortisol production. Both physical and psychological stressors cause the secretion of this cycle. And for example, psychological stressors, if a monkey in a cage sees another monkey across the room getting food and the monkey is not getting the same food, that monkey shows a huge burst of cortisol. It's not just physical stressors, but it's psychological stressors that can cause this cortisol secretion. Now, as this part of the slide makes clear, is that the cortisol does all sorts of important good things acutely. It actually enhances the immune system, the function of the immune system, so you can fight a disease if you're injured or repair a wound. It enhances aspects of memory that are important for surviving danger, remembering where the danger was. It promotes energy replenishment and more efficient cardiovascular function. But it also chronically, cortisol or high levels of cortisol do indeed suppress immune function. And we often use this to our advantage with an autoimmune disease or in the case of an inflammation, to suppress an inflammation. But it can also suppress good immunity and impair fighting a disease. High levels of cortisol and chronic stress will impair memory, and you'll hear more about their effects on brain function. And chronic cortisol promotes bone mineral loss, muscle wasting, and is part of what's called the metabolic syndrome. So we talk about an inverted U-shaped dose response curve, and you'll hear more of that as we go on. Moreover, cortisol, which is here, is part of a network of interacting mediators of adaptation, including both pro- and anti-inflammatory cytokines, sympathetic and parasympathetic activity, another steroid from the adrenal called dehydroepiandrosterone, which kind of counterbalances cortisol, and oxidative stress, which we hear about as a bad thing, but we need free radicals for our bodies to work normally. The problem is too much of them can cause damage to DNA and so forth. And what we have to also keep in mind is that this network of mediators, and this is even a larger network, it isn't possible to put them on the slide, all the mediators, they are simultaneously affecting the brain, the immune system, the metabolic system, the cardiovascular system, the other body systems. Moreover, so as a result, their interactions, because each mediator affects the other mediators, they are biphasic and nonlinear. You have the inverted U, and more than that, you have the interferences. For example, cortisol suppresses inflammation, parasympathetic activity activates anti-inflammatory processes, et cetera, et cetera. Finally, these, as you'll see shortly, this network is dysregulated by unhealthy lifestyle, including poor sleep, but also by toxic chemicals that we breathe, including, you know, inflammatory processes that we're exposed to all the time through factors in the environment. And then we bring in our behavior, the lifestyle. And it goes without, almost without saying that how we respond to being stressed out is very important for the kind of physiology that we have. So if we're stressed out, we may lose sleep at night, we may eat too many of the wrong things, drink too much alcohol, smoke, and neglect regular moderate exercise, physical activity that we know is good for us. All of these, in turn, feed into this network and contribute to allostatic load. So this is another reason why psychosocial stress is such a major factor. Talking about stressors, we can talk about trauma and abuse, major life events, and the common environmental stressors of our work, our home, our neighborhood, our nation, and so forth. Another way of talking about stress, using sort of common language, is to talk about positive stress, exhilaration from a challenge like giving a talk, doing something that where you have a good feeling at the outcome. You have to have good self-esteem, good sense of yourself for this. Then we have something called tolerable stress, where we have good self-esteem, good sense of ourself. We have then adverse life events, a major life event, but we have good internal mechanisms, good social and emotional support, and we can survive. We are resilient and get, bounce back. Finally, there is toxic stress, which really refers to a lack of sense of control, which is so important, which may be due in part to poor social and emotional support, but it may also be due in part to compromised brain architecture due to early life events, which I'll talk about later on, including what I'll refer to as a context-sensitive genotype, which can make matters worse under adverse circumstances. And finally, we come to the brain. And we study what happens to the brain under stress in our laboratory. And I'm going to tell you some things. I'll try to explain the more technical aspects. I think you'll find them interesting, even if you don't understand the details. I'm going to talk about three brain areas. The hippocampus, which is involved in remembering things in space and time, but it also helps to shut off our physiological stress response. The amygdala, which is located here, the hippocampus is here, the amygdala is here, which is important for emotions, fear, and anxiety, and also aggression. And when it's overactive, we are either anxious or it can be aggressive. It also turns on the stress hormone response and increases heart rate. And then there's the prefrontal cortex up here, which is involved in all manner of self-regulatory behaviors. And at the end of the talk, we'll come back to the importance of the development of the prefrontal cortex. It's involved in decision-making, working memory, mood and impulse control. It also shuts off the physiological stress response. So we'll talk about these three brain areas, starting with the hippocampus. But first, I'll tell you that one of the revelations in the last 20 or so years, increasingly so, has been the notion that even the adult brain is plastic, that the architecture of the brain can be remodeled, as we say, by experiences, including stressful experiences. You know that nerve cells have a cell body with a cell nucleus. They have dendrites that reach out and receive input from other nerve cells through chemical transmitters. These inputs occur on dendritic spines. There are synapses on each of these that release chemicals like glutamate, which activate nerve impulses. And these spines, at least subsets of them, turn over continuously in our brains throughout adult life. And finally, much to many people's surprise, there is a limited amount of neurogenesis, the generation of new nerve cells, in that part of the brain called the hippocampus, which you'll hear about more about shortly. If we look at a nerve cell and consider how cortisol acts, it acts primarily through nuclear receptor sites that bind to DNA and activate gene expression. That was the original idea. It also can work indirectly on gene expression through receptors near the cell surface and then other signals that go into the nucleus and either increase or decrease gene expression. But it turns out that glucocorticoids also bind to receptors that can go into mitochondria. These are the energy generators of the cell, and they regulate in a biphasic way the generation of free radicals. They also help to protect the brain from having or cells from too much free radicals, but they're very important in helping maintain homeostasis within these brain cells. But glucocorticoids are not done there. They work directly on membranes to stimulate the release of some of the chemical transmitters, like glutamate, which you'll hear about shortly. But they also work indirectly to stimulate the production of endocannabinoids. Endocannabinoids are the brain's reason that we respond to marijuana. They are lipids that are actually generated in the brain. They act then postsynaptically. This is the receiving neuron. They work back on the neuron that's releasing the neurotransmitter, and they inhibit the release of the neurotransmitter. So there's a balance, a counterbalancing you consider the many ways that we now know that cortisol is affecting brain cells as well as other cells in the body. Now, some time ago, at the beginning of my career, we discovered somewhat serendipitously that the hippocampus has receptors for adrenal steroids, for cortisol. And these receptors we identified in the cell nucleus using a radioactive labeling, but also we can see it using other methods. The receptors, the main receptors, end up in the cell nucleus. We now know from the previous slide that there are some of these same receptors in other parts of the cell, in the mitochondria, near the membrane, and so forth. But at the time, we focused on the receptors that were in the cell nucleus that were able to regulate the expression of genes. Now, the hippocampus, as I told you, is not only involved in spatial memory and memory of daily events, but it's also involved in regulating mood. It's a target of depression, and you'll hear more about that shortly. What is special about the hippocampus is that it receives input from the cortex, from the entorhinal cortex, and this is the input that degenerates in the early stages of Alzheimer's disease. Now, this input then innervates this area called the dentate gyrus, where this is where neurogenesis takes place that can be reduced by stress. But it also innervates this area called the CA3. This is called the trisynaptic circuit. And there is a feed-forward feedback loop, which is important for the memory function of the hippocampus, but at the same time, it makes it vulnerable to seizures. Seizures will actually cause permanent cell loss of these CA3 neurons. With repeated stress, we don't see cell loss. That's important. This is not brain damage. We see that these apical dendrites become shorter and less branched. This is something which you also see in a hibernating animal. And we think what this is doing is reducing the amount of excitatory input to actually protect these cells from being permanently damaged or destroyed when they don't have enough energy supply and when they might be driven by excessive activity. So this is the circuit we've been studying. And we also know that the neurogenesis, which happens in the inner part of the dentate gyrus, this part here, is actually suppressed by repeated stress. But you'll see shortly that neurogenesis is increased by regular physical activity, exercise. I'll come back to that momentarily. Now, I mentioned neurotransmitters. There are excitatory transmitters that are released to start nerve cells becoming active. There are inhibitory transmitters. GABA, gamma-aminobutyric acid, is an inhibitory one. And these play a very important role in everything we're talking about. They're important in the plasticity, the remodeling that I mentioned. But they are also important in brain damage. And when they get out of control, the glutamate gets out of control, it causes the permanent damage, as in seizures. Now, during an acute stress, we know there's an increase of extracellular glutamate, which doesn't happen when the animal does not have adrenal cortex, when it is adrenalectomized. So we knew from the beginning, or from early on, that adrenal secretions had something to do with this glutamate elevation. And as I said, the apical dendrites are reversibly melted down, so to speak, but they can bounce back when the stress is over. And this is very important to keep in mind. This is not brain damage. There is a receptor on the presynaptic side called mGlu2, which normally inhibits glutamate release. And the reason that this is important is that it does the inadequate mGlu2 allows glutamate to be spilled over and can cause downstream changes in the brain, such as shrinkage of dendrites, ultimately free radicals that can cause brain damage. And it's thought to be involved in depressive illness, And one part of the hippocampus, the dentate gyrus, is particularly important for treatment by antidepressants. And there is an antidepressant, that actually works through an epigenetic mechanism, causing histone to unwind the DNA so it can express itself. And one of the genes that's expressed is this MGLU2, which is deficient in a depressive-like state. And there is a substance called acetylcarnitine, which is a naturally occurring substance that actually in the United States can be bought in a health food store, which has rapid antidepressant effects because, at least in part, because it causes the acetylation of a histone, exposes the DNA, it upregulates this MGLU2, and the excess glutamate is shut off. That's at least the hypothesis, but it's supported pretty well. Whether this will then come into use in humans is a matter to be seen, but there's a lot of interest in other kinds of antidepressants, rapidly acting ones, because ones like fluoxetine or Prozac actually work very slowly and not in everybody with depression. Now, if you take an animal that's exposed to an acute stress or an animal that's been chronically stressed with another kind of stress and then exposed to an acute stress, or been chronically stressed and allowed to recover, so all of these changes I've talked about have taken place, and then it's given this acute novel stress. The bottom line here is that in each case, a different pattern of genes are turned on and off in the hippocampus. The most interesting points here are that an injection of cortisol does not mimic the effects of either acute or chronic stress. There's overlap. There's a set of genes that seems to be common to these. Moreover, after chronic stress, an immediate acute stress turns on and off a much larger number of genes, as if the genome is opened up in a way. What this means is that the brain is continually changing, and even though we see a restoration of the shrunken dendrites, this is not the same brain as it was before. And that's something to keep in mind in the context of the life course. Now, there's another way of modifying histones through methylation, which actually causes repression of gene expression. And using antibodies for this methylated form of histones, we've seen this incredible increase in the dentate gyrus, but also in the other parts of the hippocampus, in this methylated histone. And you can use the antibody to precipitate the DNA, actually the clump DNA that's not providing any information. And you find it includes amongst itself the so-called transposons and retrotransposons, which constitute about 40% of the human genome. And nobody really understands what this does, although there are some hints. For example, the retrotransposons produce RNAs which don't code for any proteins. They actually regulate the expression of other genes. And what you see here is that the expression of those RNAs is vastly reduced by acute stress because of this clumping of the chromatin. So these are genes that are not, and DNA that's not providing any information. The interesting part of this is that with repeated stress, this repression is lost. With aging, this repression is lost. And the question is whether this leads to genomic instability, because going back to the work of Barbara McClintock, who studied corn maize, you know that these different colored kernels are because in those kernels, there has been the cutting out of a piece of retrotransposon or transposon and insertion in another place in the DNA. So this is not just epigenetics. This is actually modifying the sequence of DNA. And incidentally, it's this modification of the DNA sequence, which is part of the generation of immunoglobulins in the immune system that leads to the diversity of antibodies. But this may be a good thing, it may be a bad thing. Genomic instability may cause things which are normally not expressed to be expressed, or things which should be expressed not to be expressed. And this may be a problem with the aging and chronically stressed brain. So we come back to the inverted U-shaped dose response curve, and we see acutely that, especially if we talk about cortisol and glutamate as two of the mediators, there are others, acutely they actually improve excitability, help us remember things, as I've said, they improve functions in the brain. A more intense acute stress can lead to the opposite, that is the downward limb of the inverted U, less activity, impairment of certain kinds of memory. And then we have this thing which we call adaptive plasticity, the changing in architecture, the suppression of neurogenesis. And then we can also talk about the damage potentiation, which I mentioned with a seizure, stroke, or head trauma, where glutamate and cortisol work together to cause permanent irreversible damage. The interesting other possibility is the loss of resilience. And we think in mental health disorders, anxiety and depressive disorders, the ability of the brain to be resilient, to change after a stressful experience, may be temporarily lost. It's normal in a dangerous environment to become more anxious, to become more vigilant, and after a serious event in one's life to become somewhat depressed. But if you don't bounce back, then you've got to be treated with an antidepressant medication or behavioral therapy or a combination of both. And that's what we're interested in with the study of antidepressants. Now, studies not in our lab, but of many other people throughout the world, have shown that in the human hippocampus, as we might have predicted from the animal studies, becomes smaller in chronic major depression. It also becomes smaller in type 2 diabetes, in post-traumatic stress disorder, and in Cushing's disease, which, as you may know, is an elevation of cortisol. The good news about Cushing's is if you correct the hypercortisolemia, there's at least partial recovery of brain volume and mood and memory within the next 6 months to a year. But you don't have to have a disease to see hippocampal dysfunction and shrinkage. A lifelong history or 20-year history of chronic stress is associated with a smaller hippocampus. Those people who fly regularly transmeridianally may show a smaller hippocampus and impaired memory if they don't have enough time to recover between flights. Lack of exercise, I'll tell you more about in a moment, and chronic inflammation, which is associated certainly with type 2 diabetes and other of the non-communicable diseases. The good news is that the hippocampal size increases with regular exercise, with intense learning, and with antidepressant treatments, of which regular exercise is one of the best for mild to moderate depression. And as an illustration of this, this is a study that was done at the University of Illinois, taking sedentary adults in their 60s and 70s, getting them to walk an hour a day, 5 out of 7 days a week, showing that over 6 months to a year, the volume of the hippocampus increased, their memory improved, other parts of their brain function also improved. So this is extremely important, regular physical activity that can affect the brain favorably even as one gets older. I mentioned type 2 diabetes, and the brain, especially the hippocampus, is sensitive to the metabolic hormones, ghrelin, which is a gut hormone that makes us hungry, leptin, a fat hormone that can actually enhance cognitive function. It inhibits appetite. Insulin, of course, is very important, has neuroprotective effects. And insulin-like growth factor 1 from the liver, if you immunoneutralize this, that is prevent it from reduce its level in the circulation, you stop exercise-induced neurogenesis. Again, an illustration of how functions in the body influence the brain. Type 2 diabetes, of course, is also a risk factor for dementia later in life. And there's also an increasing problem with teenagers with type 2 diabetes showing already impairment of their hippocampal function, which, again, is a bit scary with the amount of obesity that we see around us. So then we will come to this life course health development, which I'm about then to show you a video which will speak for itself about brain development.
Learning to deal with stress is an important part of healthy development. When experiencing stress, the stress response system is activated. The body and brain go on alert. There's an adrenaline rush, increased heart rate, and an increase in stress hormone levels. When the stress is relieved after a short time, or a young child receives support from caring adults, the stress response winds down and the body quickly returns to normal. In severe situations, such as ongoing abuse and neglect, where there is no caring adult to act as a buffer against the stress response stays activated. Even when there is no apparent physical harm, the extended absence of response from adults can activate the stress response system. Constant activation of the stress response overloads developing systems with serious, lifelong consequences for the child. This is known as toxic stress. Over time, this results in a stress response system set permanently on high alert. In the areas of the brain dedicated to learning and reasoning, the neural connections that comprise brain architecture are weaker and fewer in number. Science shows that the prolonged activation of stress hormones in early childhood can actually reduce neural connections in these important areas of the brain at just the time when they should be growing new ones. Toxic stress can be avoided if we ensure that the environments in which children grow and develop are nurturing, stable, and engaging.
So we'll hear more about that as we go forward. Which brings us then to this last view of this particular slide, talking about individual differences that may be due to our genetic constitution, early life events, and experiences throughout the rest of our life. And I'll explain to you what we mean by context-sensitive alleles and more on the epigenetic story that I've already told you some about. So Avshalom Kaspi and his colleagues, Terry Moffitt and others, looking at genes, genetic information that they collected in their studies in Dunedin, New Zealand, identified variants of two genes, monoamine oxidase and the serotonin transporter, which both of which are involved in these important monoamines that are involved in mood and other aspects of behavior. They found that one allele or variant increased the risk whether childhood abuse will be transmitted from the abuser to child, which is a very interesting phenomenon where the abusee often will seek a partner who has characteristics of the abusive parent. The other allele reduces that risk, but in order for these to be seen, these effects to be seen, there has to be abuse in the person's life. The serotonin transporter variants either increase or decrease the risk for depressive illness. Now, do we think about these things as good genes or bad genes? Well, a new way of thinking about them is to think about them as context-sensitive alleles or like orchids, which if you have that version of the serotonin transporter gene, for example, you are more vulnerable to early life abuse and neglect, that is a high conflict situation, and higher levels of externalizing behavior. But if you're in a low conflict situation, there may be even less than normal, whereas the other allele is not as strongly affected by the context. So that's the dandelion. And we're going to see plenty of dandelions, if not already, around us this spring. On the positive sense, the context-sensitive allele, the orchid allele, means in a low adversity environment, better school engagement compared to the dandelion allele, but in a high conflict situation, less school engagement. So these are not necessarily bad genes, they're context-sensitive genes, and we're just beginning as a field to identify what some of them may be. There are enormous numbers of genes to be considered. Now, we know that in a child's life, low socioeconomic status has been characterized in terms of its effect on poor language skills and poor executive function and other aspects of learning ability, related in part at least to whether the parents are stimulating the child with verbal and other stimulation. We'll hear more about that shortly in another video. Chaos in the home leads to poor self-regulatory behavior, again, impaired development of the prefrontal cortex, but it also has been associated with obesity, with elevated blood pressure, and increased cardiovascular reactivity. And there are lasting effects on body fat accumulation and systemic inflammation, as documented by various people, including the Dunedin study, that result, among other things, in poor dental health. And then there's something called risky families. There is not outright abuse, but there's neglect, a cold, unsupportive environment, and this leads to many of the same consequences that one sees in the better understood situation, which are the adverse childhood experiences, or ACE. These include things like psychological abuse, physical abuse, sexual abuse by parents or anyone in the family, or even neighbors, emotional and physical neglect, or household dysfunction, which includes alcoholism or drug abuse in the home, divorce, depression or mental illness in the home, mother being treated violently, or an imprisoned household member. Now, any single or even a couple of these things in a person's life isn't necessarily bad, but it's when they are clustered together that there's an almost exponential rise in outcomes, which include increased levels of heart disease, smoking risk, obesity, drug abuse, higher risk for AIDS, depression, anxiety, anger control, and other kinds of antisocial behavior. These have been documented by Anda and Felitti, and it's noteworthy that their study by the Center for Disease Control in the U.S. was carried out in the Kaiser Permanente Health System. These are not poor people. This is middle class, and we know that this ACE is a worldwide phenomenon at virtually all levels of socioeconomic status, and it increases the lifelong risk for these non-communicable diseases that we're talking about. This is an example of inflammatory response to a major life event in people who have had no early life, a very supportive early life environment, as opposed to increasing levels of harshness in the family related to ACE, related to verbal abuse, but the other factors that constitute ACE. So the more family harshness there is, the more reactivity in terms of an inflammatory response, which in this kind of inflammatory response is a risk factor, not necessarily a protective factor for the body and brain. So then we come back to the methylation of these cytosine residues as part of epigenetics. And this is a study that grows out of work by Michael Meany and Moshe Ziff and colleagues in Montreal, showing that early life poor maternal care in an animal model leads to increasing levels of methylation of, believe it or not, the receptor for cortisol. And if you don't have enough receptor for cortisol, you're not going to be able to do all the good things that the cortisol does to the brain and the body. And you can see this was a study of suicide in which people who had a documented history of abuse early in life had a higher level of methylation of their glucocorticoid receptor promoter, the one that governs the expression of this receptor, compared to those who were non-abused or a control population. So this was a translation from the animal model to the human, and it certainly suggests that we can make these translations from animal studies to humans and vice versa. So the human brain under stress in terms of development, the hippocampus is smaller in early life abuse, low self-esteem, it results in a smaller hippocampus and also an increased risk for post-traumatic stress disorder. So they're all connected, early life abuse leading to low self-esteem, increased risk for PTSD. The amygdala is larger and more reactive in depression and anxiety disorders. And what I haven't told you is that dendrites of the amygdala actually grow and become more innervated even while the hippocampus shrinks. So the animal or the person becomes more anxious even as the hippocampus and also the prefrontal cortex becomes less efficient in doing its job. The prefrontal cortex, as I've already said, is underdeveloped with chaos, early life abuse, and we're about ready to see another video about the prefrontal cortex, but just noting that these early life events may occur prenatally in terms of even germline transmission of risk for obesity, for example, some suggestions for that, biological embedding of things that I just talked about with adverse childhood experiences. And in adolescence, there's a period of reduced fear learning, but also a reduced fear extinction. So it's a vulnerable period that's different from the others, which is often then leads to later outcomes. So let's see this second video.
The key to forming strong brain architecture is what's known as serve and return interaction with adults. In this developmental game, new neural connections form in the brain as young children instinctively serve through babbling facial expressions and gestures. And adults return the serve, responding in a very directed, meaningful way. It starts very early in life, when a baby coos and the adult interacts and directs the baby's attention to a face or hand. This interaction forms the foundation of brain architecture upon which all future development will be built. It helps create neural connections between all the different areas of the brain, building the emotional and cognitive skills children need in life. For example, here's how it works for literacy and language skills. When the baby sees an object, the adult says its name. This makes connections in the baby's brain between particular sounds and their corresponding objects. Later, adults show young children that those objects and sounds can also be represented by marks on a page. With continued support from adults, children then learn how to decipher writing and eventually to write themselves. Each stage builds on what came before. Ensuring that children have adult caregivers who consistently engage and serve in return interaction, beginning in infancy, builds a foundation in the brain for all the learning, behavior, and health that follow.
So we'll talk then about the prefrontal cortex, which I've mentioned earlier, which under stress shows a shrinkage of dendrites, an impairment of what we call cognitive flexibility, an impairment of the ability to exert the downstream control that we call self-regulation. And one way of thinking about it is as the air traffic control system of the brain, trying to figure out and make plans, decisions, keep track of information, revise plans, and above all, resist hasty actions, that is, reducing impulsivity. And without adequate development, then the individual is perhaps more impulsive, less able to control emotions and other aspects of their behavior. So executive function is a key biological foundation of everything, including school readiness and outcomes in terms of health and employability. And it's a system that develops in the brain after birth. And so it's particularly sensitive to all these things we're talking about in terms of early life adversity. So what are these executive function skills? They include inhibitory control, reduced impulsivity, working memory, and cognitive flexibility to be able to change. And incidentally, the regular exercise I mentioned earlier in elderly adults improves cognitive flexibility, working memory, and inhibitory control. So higher childhood self-control predicts better adult health, greater wealth, and less adult crime. And this is something I'll document shortly about return on investment in terms of dollars, at least as estimated in the United States. So what's important to be done? Obviously, a balanced approach to emotional, social, cognitive, and language development as early as possible in an infant and child's life. Supportive relationships, very important, but strengthened by others, not only parents, but others outside the home. And then highly specialized interventions that as early as possible for families and relationships that are in trouble. And this is, if you don't know it, the nurse-family partnership is a very good, one of the programs that seems to be very effective. So in terms of return on investment over various periods of time, the Abbasidarian Project in North Carolina estimated just through age 21, $3 for $1 invested. The nurse family partnership up to the point where this was calculated at $5.70. And the longest running one is called the Perry School Project through age 40. At $9 return, less crime, greater income, less dependent on social services, better overall health, less burden on the healthcare system, and so on. So then, finally, when things go wrong, and for all of us, what can be done to improve and maybe treat the effects of early adversity? Well, this is an ongoing thing. We don't know the answers, but there are some things I've already mentioned which do change the brain. The idea is to find things that will open windows of plasticity, since we know the brain is plastic, and then push it in the right direction. So regular physical activity, I've already told you about that several times. Something I haven't mentioned is mindfulness-based stress reduction. We hear more and more about being mindful, focusing on the present. Stop ruminating about things you cannot control. This has been effective now and reported to be effective in elementary school and junior high school in reducing disruption and improving attention. And it appears also to be recognized as being effective in adults. This one study that has been published shows that people who have a chronic anxiety disorder, which might have been the result of early life adversity, if they respond with reduced anxiety to a mindfulness-based stress reduction program, their amygdala volume decreases. And we know, as I said briefly, that chronic stress causes the amygdala to become hyperactive, even as it causes these other brain areas, neurons, to shrink and become less effective. And finally, there are programs involving social support and integration. The Experience Corps in the US is an example where elderly volunteers became teachers' aides in elementary schools. They formed a social group amongst themselves. They received training, a little bit of car fare for getting to where the schools. They helped improve the education process in elementary schools, but their health, including their brain health, was also documented to be better. And one cannot discount the importance of meaning and purpose, or as the term eudaimonia, in all of this. Not just physical activity, social interactions, but doing something that has meaning and purpose. So looking to the future, this is the challenge for science, but also for all of us, not magic, there's no magic bullet that's going to do this. The best we can hope for, even with pharmaceutical agents like antidepressants, is that they may help to open up a window of plasticity, but it is the behavioral intervention that is going to help drive it in an appropriate direction and perhaps help to not to reverse the changes in the brain, but to create a counterbalance that will improve behavior and brain and body function overall. And this from the MacArthur Foundation network I was part of, but also going back to the Acheson report here in the UK, saying that all public policies are in one way or the other health policies. Wonderful brochures or PDFs that are available on a website I can refer to anybody, and a video called Unnatural Causes, which documents a lot of what I've been talking about. The colleagues and collaborators for our basic research, but also the MacArthur Foundation and the National Scientific Council on the Developing Child based in Boston. And the last slide, really, their website is a marvelous source of information and programs and so forth. And their goals are not only to prevent, but now to reactivate plasticity and help overcome some of these problems. Thank you very much.